Pitt looked disappointed and sighed. "It's just a damn shame it's in such bad shape," he muttered, placing the skin on the towel and blinking several times. "Man, those fumes will get you. How do you work around that all the time?"
"Very, very carefully," I said. "Would you mind if I use your phone?"
"Help yourself."
I stepped behind the counter, keeping an uneasy eye on Taxi as she sat up in her bed. She stared at me as if daring me to make one move she didn't like. "It's okay," I told her in a soothing voice. "Pitt, is it all right if I page someone and give him this number?"
"It ain't a secret. Help yourself."
"You're a good girl." I encouraged Taxi to be one as I stepped around the counter to use the phone. Her small, dull eyes reminded me of a shark, her head thick and triangular like a snake's. She looked like something primitive that had evolved no further since the beginning of time, and I thought of what was written on the box inside the container.
"Could it be a wolf?" I said to Pitt. "Even a werewolf?"
Pitt sighed again, the hard work of payday weekend shadowing his eyes.
"Well, wolves are real popular. You know, pack instinct, lone wolf," he told me. "Hard to cover up one of those with a bird, an owl or whatever."
"Yeah," Marino's voice came over the line.
"Hell, it could be so many things," Pitt kept on talking loudly. "Coyote, dog, cat, whatever's got a furry coat and yellow eyes with no pupils. Had to be small to cover it up with an owl, though. Real small."
"Who the hell is that talking about a furry coat?" Marino rudely asked. I told him where I was and why, Pitt rambling on all the while, pointing out all sorts of furry flash on a wall.
"Great!" Marino got mad right away. "Why don't you get one while you're there?"
"Maybe another time."
"I can't believe you would go to a tattoo parlor alone. You got an idea the kind of people who go in a place like that? Drug dealers, assholes out on parole, motorcycle gangs."
"It's all right."
"Oh, no, it ain't all right," Marino erupted.
He was upset about something that went beyond my visiting a tattoo parlor. "What's wrong, Marino?"
"Not a damn thing, unless you consider being suspended without pay something wrong."
"There's no justification for that," I angrily said, although I'd been afraid it was inevitable.
"Bray thinks so. I guess I ruined her dinner last night. She says if I do one more thing, I'm fired. The good news is I'm having fun thinking what the one more thing is I might decide to do." "Hey, let me show you something," Pitt called out to me from across the room.
"We'll do something about this," I promised Marino.
"Yeah."
Taxi's eyes followed me as I hung up and picked my way around her. I scanned the flash on the wall and only felt worse. I wanted the tattoo to be a wolf, a werewolf, a small one, when in fact it could be something else entirely and probably was. I couldn't tolerate it when a question remained unanswered, when science and rational thinking went as far as they could go and quit. I couldn't remember ever feeling this discouraged and unsettled. The wall seemed to move in on me, and sheets of flash jumped out like demons. Daggers through hearts and skulls, gravestones, skeletons, evil animals, and ghastly ghouls played ring around the rosy with me.
"Why do people want to wear death?"
I raised my voice, and Taxi raised her head. "Isn't living with it enough? Why would someone want to spend the rest of his life looking at death on his arm?" Pitt shrugged and didn't seem bothered in the least that I was questioning his art.
"See," he said, "when you think about it, Doc, there's nothing to fear but fear. So people want death tattoos so they won't be afraid of death. It's kind of like people who are terrified by snakes and then touch one in the zoo. In a way, you wear death every day, too," he said to me. "Don't you think you might fear it more if you didn't look at it every day?"
I didn't know how to answer that.
"See, you got a piece of a dead person's skin in that jar, and you're not afraid of it," he went on. "But someone else walking in here and seeing that would probably scream or puke. Now, I'm no psychologist,"
he vigorously chewed gum,
"but there's something real important behind what someone chooses to have permanently drawn on his body. So you take this dead guy? That owl says something about him. What went on inside, most of all what he was scared of, which may have more to do with whatever's under that owl."
It would seem that quite a lot of your clients are afraid of voluptuous naked women, I commented. Pitt chewed his gum as if it were trying to get away, and he pondered what I'd said for a moment.
Hadn't thought about that one, he said, but it fits. Most of these guys with nudies all over them are really scared of women. Scared of the emotional part.
Chuck had turned on the TV and was watching Rosie O'Donnell, the volume low. I had seen thousands of tattoos on bodies, but I had never thought of them as a symbol of fear. Pitt tapped the jar of formalin's lid.
This guy was afraid of something, he said. Looks like he might have had a good reason to be.
23. I'd been home only long enough to hang up my coat and drop my briefcase by the door when the telephone rang. It was 8:20, and my first thought was Lucy. The only update I'd gotten was that Joe would be transferred to MCV sometime this weekend. I was frightened and becoming resentful. No matter what policies, protocols, or judgment dictated, Lucy could contact me. She could let me know she and Joe were all right. She could tell me where she was. I quickly grabbed the phone and was both surprised and uneasy when former Deputy Chief Al Carson's voice came over the line. I knew he would not contact me, especially at home, unless it was very important. The news very bad.
I'm not supposed to be doing this, but someone has to, he said right off. There's been a homicide at the Quick Carry, that convenience store off Carry near Libby. You know which one I mean? Kind of a neighborhood market.
He was talking rapidly and nervously. He sounded scared. Yes, I said. It's close to my house. I picked up a clipboard and began writing notes on a call sheet.
An apparent robbery. Someone came in, cleaned out the drawer, and shot the clerk, a female.
I thought of the videotape I had looked at yesterday. When did this happen? I asked.
We think she got shot not more than an hour ago. I'm calling you myself because your office doesn't know yet.
I paused, not quite sure what he meant. In fact, what he'd just said couldn't possibly be right.
I called Marino, too, he went on. I guess there's nothing more they can do to me anymore.
What do you mean my office doesn't know yet? I asked.
Police aren't supposed to be calling the ME anymore until we finish with the scene. Until the crime techs do, and they're just now getting there. So it could be hours...
Where the hell is this coming from? I asked, although I knew.
Dr. Scarpetta, I was pretty much forced to resign, but I would have anyway, Carson told me. There are changes I can't live with. You know my guys have always gotten along really well with your office. But Bray's put in all these new people. What she did to Marino, that was enough to make me quit right there. But what matters right now is this makes 2 convenience store killings in a month. I don't want anything messed up. If it's the same guy, he's going to do it again.
I called Fielding at home and told him what was going on.
You want me to...
He started to say. No, I cut him off. I'm going right now. We're getting goddamn screwed, Jack. I drove fast. Bruce Springsteen was singing Santa Claus is Coming to Town, and I thought of Bray. I had never really hated anyone before. Hate was poison. I had always resisted it. To hate was to lose, and it was all I could do right now to resist the heat of its flames. The news came on, the homicide the lead story covered live at the scene.
In what is the second convenience store murder in 3 weeks? Deputy Chief Bray, what can you tell us?
Details are sketchy at this time, her voice sounded inside my car. We do know that several hours earlier an unknown suspect entered the Quick Carry here and robbed it and shot the clerk.
My car phone rang.
Where are you? Marino said.
Getting close to Libby.
I'm going to pull into the Carytown parking lot. I need to tell you what's going on because nobody's going to tell you the time of day when you get there.
We'll see about that. Minutes later, I turned into the small shopping center and parked in front of Schwarzschild's Jewelers, where Marino was sitting in his truck. Then he was inside my car wearing jeans and boots and a scuffed leather coat with a broken zipper and fleece lining as bald as his head. He had splashed on a lot of cologne, meaning he had been drinking beer. He tossed a cigarette butt, and red ashes sailed through the night.
"Everything's under control," he sardonically said. "Anderson's at the scene, and Bray. She's holding a goddamn press conference outside the convenience store," Marino said with disgust. "Let's go."
I drove back out to Carey Street.
"Start with this, Doc," he began. "The asshole shoots her at the counter in the head. Then it's looking like he puts out the closed sign, locks the door, and drags her to the back into the storeroom and beats the holy shit out of her."
"He shot her and then beat her up?"
"Yeah."
"How were the police notified?" I asked.
"At 7:16, the burglar alarm went off," he replied. "The back door's armed even when the joint's open for business. Cops get there and find the front door locked, closed sign out, like I said. They go around back, find that door wide open. They go in, she's on the floor, blood everywhere. Tentatively identified as Kim Luong, 30-year-old Asian female."
Bray continued to dominate the news.
"You said something earlier about a witness," a reporter was asking her.
"Only that a citizen reported seeing a male in dark clothing in the area around the time we believe the homicide took place," Bray replied. "He was ducking into an alleyway right down the block there. The person who reported this did not get a good look. We're hoping if someone else did, he'll call us. No detail is too small. It takes all of us to protect our community."
"What's she doing, running for office?" Marino said.
"Is there a safe somewhere inside the store?" I asked him.
"In the back where her body was found. It hadn't been opened, so I've been told."
"Video camera?" I asked.
"Nope. Maybe he learned after whacking Gant and is hitting joints that aren't doing the candid camera number on him."
"Maybe."
He and I both knew he was making assumptions, pushing hard because he wasn't about to let go of his job.
"Carson tell you all this?" I asked.
"It ain't the cops who've suspended me," he answered. "And already I know you're thinking the M.O.'s a little different. But it ain't a science, Doc, you know that."
Benton used to toss that line at us with that wry smile of his. He was a profiler, an expert in modus operandi and patterns and predicting. But each crime had its own special choreography because every victim was different. Circumstances and moods were different. Even the weather was different, and the killer often modified his routine. Benton used to complain about Hollywood renditions of what behavioral scientists could do. He wasn't clairvoyant, and violent people weren't driven by software.
"Maybe she pissed him off or something," Marino went on. "Maybe he'd just had a bad conversation with his mother. Who the hell knows?"
"What's going to happen when people like Al Carson don't call you anymore?"
"It's my damn case," he said, as if he hadn't heard me. "Gant was my case, and this one is too, any way you look at it. Even if it's not the same killer, who's gonna figure that out before I do, since I'm the one who knows everything there is about it?"
"You can't always barge in with both barrels going," I said. "That's not going to work with Bray. You've got to find a way to make it worth her while to tolerate you, and you better figure that out in the next 5 minutes." He was silent as I turned onto Libby Avenue.
"You're smart, Marino," I added. "Use your head. This isn't about turf or egos. This is about a woman who's dead."
"Shit," he said.
"What the fuck's wrong with people?"
The Quick Carry was a small market that had neither a plate glass front nor gas pumps. It wasn't brightly lit up or located in a spot that attracted customers either coming off or getting on heavily traveled roads. Except during the holidays, it stayed open only until 6. The parking lot throbbed red and blue, and in the midst of rumbling engines, cops, and an awaiting rescue crew, Bray gloried in an aura of television lights that floated around her like a flotilla of small suns. She was dressed in a long red wool cape, heels, and diamond earrings that flashed with each turn of her beautiful head. By all appearances, she had just rushed out of a black tie party. It was beginning to sleet as I lifted my crime case out of the trunk. Bray spotted me before the media did, and then her eyes found Marino and anger touched her face. "We'll not release that until her family has been notified," she was saying to the press.
"Watch this," Marino said under his breath.
He walked with a sense of urgency toward the store and did something I'd never seen him do before. He left himself wide open for a media ambush. He even went so far as to get on his portable radio as he tensely cast about, sending out every signal imaginable that he was in charge and knew many secrets.
"You in there, 202, his voice carried to me as I locked up my car.
10-4, a voice came back.
"In front, coming in," Marino mumbled.
"Meet ya."
At least 10 reporters and cameramen instantly surrounded him. It was amazing how fast they moved. Captain Marino? Captain Marino! How much money was stolen? Marino didn't shoo them off. Bray's eyes dragged across his face like claws as all attention shifted to him, this man whose neck her foot was on. Did they keep less than $60 in the drawer like other convenience stores do? Do you think convenience stores should have security guards this time of year? Marino, unshaven and full of beer, looked into the cameras and said, If it was my store, I sure as hell would. I locked my car. Bray was walking toward me. So you attribute these two robbery homicides to the Christmas season? Another reporter said to Marino. I attribute them to some squirrel who's cold-blooded and got no conscience. He'll do it again, Marino answered. And we've got to stop him, and that's what we're trying to do. Bray confronted me as I made my way around police cars. She had her cape pulled tightly around her, and she was as cold and stinging as the weather. Why do you let him do this? She asked me. I stopped in my tracks and looked her in the eye, my frosted breath puffing like a cold train about to run her over. Let is not a word I use with Marino, I said. I suspect you're finding that out the hard way. A reporter for a local gossip magazine raised his voice above the others and said, Captain Marino, talk on the street is you're not a detective anymore. What are you doing here? Deputy Chief Bray has me on special assignment, Marino grimly replied into microphones. I'll be heading up this investigation. He's finished, Bray said to me. He won't go quietly. You'll never hear so much noise in your life, I promised her as I walked off. 24. Marino met me at the store's front door. When we stepped inside, the first person we saw was Anderson. She stood in front of the counter, wrapping the empty cash drawer in brown paper as crime scene technician Al Eggleston dusted the cash register for prints. Anderson looked surprised and unhappy when she saw us. What are you doing here? She confronted Marino. Came in to buy a six-pack. How you doing, Eggleston? Same old, Pete. We're not ready for you yet, Anderson said to me. I ignored her and wondered how much damage she'd already done to the scene. Thank God Eggleston was doing the important work. I immediately noticed the overturned chair behind the counter. Was the chair like that when the police got here? I asked Eggleston. Far as I know. Anderson abruptly went out of the store, probably to find Bray. Uh-oh, Marino said. Tattletale. You ain't kidding. On the wall behind the counter were arcs of blood from an arterial hemorrhage. Glad you're here, Pete, but you're poking a snake with a stick. The sweeping trail led around the counter and through the aisle farthest from the store's front door. Marino, come here, I said. Hey, Eggleston, see if you can find the guy's DNA somewhere. Put it in a little bottle and maybe we can grow his clone in the lab, Marino said as he walked over to me. Then we'll know who the hell he is. You're a rocket scientist, Pete. I pointed out the arcs of blood made by the rise and fall of the systolic rhythm of Kim Luong's heart as she had bled to death through her carotid. The blood was low to the floor and stretched over some 20 feet of shelves stocked with paper towels, toilet paper, and other household needs. Jesus Christ, Marino said as the significance hit him. He's dragging her while she's spurting blood everywhere? Yes. How long would she have survived bleeding like that? Minutes, I said. 10 at the most. She had left no other bloody wake except the faint, fringed, and narrow parallel impressions made by her hair and fingers as they dragged through her blood. I envisioned him pulling her feet first, her arms opening like wings filled with air, her hair trailing feathers. He had her by the ankles, I said. She has long hair. Anderson had stepped back inside and was watching us, and I hated it when I had to guard every word I said around the police. But it happened. Over the years, I had worked with cops who were terrible leaks, and I had no choice but to treat them like the enemy. She sure as hell didn't die right away, Marino added. A hole in your carotid isn't immediately disabling, I told him. You can have your throat cut and still call 911. She shouldn't have been immediately immobilized, but clearly she was. The systolic sweeps got lower and fainter the further down the aisle we went, and I noted that small blood spatters were dry, while larger amounts of blood were congealing. We followed streaks and smears past coolers full of beer, then through the doorway leading into the storeroom, where crime scene technician Gary Hamm was on his knees, while another officer took photographs, their backs to me, blocking my view. When I stepped around them, I was stunned. Kim Luong's blue jeans and panties had been pulled down to her knees, a chemical thermometer inserted into her rectum. Hamm looked up at me and he froze like someone caught stealing. We had worked together for years.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?"
I said to him in a hard tone he had never heard from me.
"Getting her temp, Doc," Hamm said.
"Did you swab her before inserting the thermometer? In the event she was sodomized?" I demanded in the same angry voice as Marino made his way around me and stared at the body. Hamm hesitated.
"No, ma'am, I didn't." "Way to fucking go," Marino said to him.
Hamm was in his late 30s, a tall, nice-looking man with dark hair and big brown eyes and long lashes. It wasn't uncommon for a little experience to begin seducing someone like him into believing he could do the forensic scientists' and medical examiners' work. But Hamm had always stayed in bounds. He'd always been respectful.
"And just how do I interpret the presence of any injury, now that you've introduced a hard object into one of her orifices?" I said to him.
He swallowed hard.
"If I find a contusion inside her rectum, can I swear in court that the thermometer didn't do it? And unless you can somehow vouch for the sterility of your equipment, any DNA recovered will be in question, too," I said.
Hamm's face was red.
"Do you have any idea how many artifacts you've just introduced to this crime scene, Officer Hamm?" I asked him.
"I've been very careful."
"Please move out of the way. Now."
I opened my case and angrily pulled on gloves, stretching my fingers and snapping latex all in one motion. I handed Marino a flashlight and studied my surroundings before I did another thing. The storeroom was dimly lit. Hundreds of six-packs of sodas and beer as far as 20 feet away were spattered with blood. Inches from the body were Tampax and paper towels, the bottom of the carton soggy with blood. So far, there was no sign the killer had been interested in anything back here except his victim. I squatted and studied the body, taking in every shade and texture of flesh and blood, every stroke of the killer's hellish art. I did not touch anything at first.
"God, he really beat the hell out of her, didn't he?"
said the cop who was taking photographs. It was as if a wild animal had dragged her dying body off to its lair and mauled it. Her sweater and bra had been ripped open, her shoes and socks removed and tossed nearby. She was a fleshy woman with matronly hips and breasts, and the only way I had a clue about what she had looked like was the driver's license I was shown. Kim Luong had been pretty, with a shy smile and shiny long black hair.
"Were her pants on when she was found?" I asked Hamm.
"Yes, ma'am."
"What about shoes and socks?"
"They were off, exactly like you see them. We didn't touch them." I didn't have to pick up her shoes and socks to see they were very bloody.
"Why would he take off her shoes and socks, but not her pants?"
one of the cops asked.
"Yeah, why would someone do something weird like that?"
I took a look. There was dried blood on the bottom of her feet, too.
"I'll have to get her under a better light when we get her to the morgue," I said.
The gunshot wound in the front of her neck was plain to see. It was an entrance wound, and I turned her head just enough to see the exit in the back, angled to the left. It was this bullet that had hit her carotid artery.
"Did you recover a bullet?" I asked Hamm.
"Dug one out of the wall behind the counter," he said, barely able to look at me. "No shell so far, if there is one." There wouldn't be if she was shot with a revolver. Pistols ejected their cartridge cases, which was about the only helpful thing they did when they were used for violence.
"Where in the wall?" I asked.
"If you're facing the counter, it would be to the left of where the chair would have been if she was sitting at the cash register." "The exit wound is also off to the left," I said. "If they were face to face when she was shot, you're probably looking for a left-handed shooter." Kim Luong's face was severely lacerated and crushed, the skin split and torn from blows that had been made by some sort of tool or tools that had a pattern of round and linear wounds. It appeared she also had been beaten with his fists. When I palpated for fractures, bits of bone crunched beneath my fingertips. Her teeth were broken and pushed in. "Hold it here," I directed Marino. He moved the flashlight as I directed, and I gently turned her head to the right and to the left, palpating her scalp through her hair and checking the back and sides of her neck. She was covered with more knuckle bruises and more of the round and linear injuries, and also striated abrasions here and there. "Except for pulling down her pants to get her body temp," I said to Ham, because I had to be sure. "She was just like this?" "Other than her jeans being zipped up and buttoned, yes, ma'am," he replied. "Her sweater and bra were just exactly like that," he pointed. "Ripped right down the middle." "With his bare hands." Marino squatted beside me. "Damn, he's strong. Doc, she would have pretty much been dead by the time he got her back here, right?"
"Not quite. She still has tissue response to her injuries. Some bruising."
"But for all practical purposes, he's beating the shit out of a dead body," Marino said. "I mean, she sure as hell wasn't sitting up and arguing with him. She wasn't struggling. You can look around and see that. Nothing knocked over or shoved around. No bloody footprints going all over the place."
"He knew her." Anderson's voice was behind me. "It had to be someone she knew. Otherwise, he probably would have just shot her and taken the money and run."
Marino was still down beside me, elbows resting on his big knees, flashlight dangling from one hand. He looked up at Anderson as if she had the intelligence of a banana.
"I didn't know you was a profiler, too," he said. "You take some classes or something?"
"Marino, if you can shine it right there," I said. "It's hard to see."
The light illuminated a blood pattern on the body that I hadn't noticed at first because I was too preoccupied with injuries. Virtually every inch of exposed flesh was smeared with bloody swirls and strokes, as if she had been finger-painted. The blood was drying and beginning to crack. And there were hairs. The same long, pale hairs stuck to her blood. I pointed this out to Marino. He bent closer. "Quiet," I warned him, as I felt his reaction and knew what I was showing him.
"Here comes the boss," Eggleston announced as he stepped carefully through the doorway.
The room was crowded and airless. It looked as if a thrashing storm had rained blood upon it.
"We're going to string all this," Ham said to me. "Recovered a cartridge case," Eggleston happily passed on to Marino.
"If you want a break, Marino, I'll hold the flashlight for her."
Ham was trying to make up for his unpardonable sin.
"I think it's fairly obvious she was lying right here, immobile, when he beat her," I said, because I didn't think stringing was necessary in this case.
"Stringing will tell us for sure," he promised.
It was an old French technique in which one end of a string was taped at a bloodstain and the other at the geometrically computed origin of the blood. This was done multiple times, resulting in a three-dimensional string model that showed how many blows were struck and where the victim was when they were.
"There's too many people in here," I loudly said.
Sweat was rolling down Marino's face. I could feel his body heat and smell his breath as he worked close to me. "Get this to Interpol right away," I told him in a voice no one else could hear.
"No kidding." "Spear 380. Ever heard of it?" Eggleston said to Marino.
"Yeah, high-performance shit. Gold dot," Marino replied. "That don't fit at all."
I got out my chemical thermometer and set it on top of a box of paper plates to get the ambient temperature.
"I can already tell you what it is, Doc," Ham said. 75.9 back here. It's warm."
Marino was moving the flashlight as my hands and eyes moved over the body.
"Normal people don't get spear ammo," he was saying. "You're talking 10, 11 bucks for a box of 20. Not to mention your gun can't be a piece of shit or the damn thing will blow apart in your hand."
"The gun probably came off the street, then." Anderson was suddenly next to me. "Drugs."
"Case solved," Marino replied. "Gee, thanks, Anderson. Hey, guys, we can all go home."
I could smell the sweet, cloying odor of Kim Luong's blood as it coagulated, the serum separating from the hemoglobin, cells breaking down. I withdrew the chemical thermometer Ham had inserted inside her. Her core temperature was 88.6 degrees. I looked up. There were three people in this room, not including Marino and me. My anger and frustration continued to build.
"We found her pocketbook and coat," Anderson went on. $16 in her billfold, so it doesn't look like he went in there. And oh, there was a paper bag nearby with a plastic container and fork. Looks like she brought dinner with her and warmed it up in the microwave."
"How do you know she warmed it up?" Marino asked.
Anderson was caught.
"Putting two and two together don't always 22, he added.
Liver mortis was in its early stages. Her jaw was set, and the small muscles of her neck and hands were, too.
"She's too stiff for only being dead a couple hours," I said.
"What causes it, anyway?" Eggleston asked.
"Me, too. I've always wondered that. I had one in Bon Air one time."
"What were you doing in Bon Air?" asked the officer, taking photographs.
"It's a long story, but this guy has a heart attack during sex. The girlfriend just thinks he's gone to sleep, right? Wakes up the next morning and he's deader than dirt. She doesn't want it to look like he died in bed, so she tries to put him in a chair. He was leaning against it like an ironing board."
"I'm serious, Doc. What causes it?" Ham asked.
"I've always been curious about that, too."
Diane Bray's voice came from the doorway. She was standing there, her eyes fastened to me like steel rivets.
"When you die, your body quits making adenosine triphosphate. That's why you get stiff," I said, not giving her a glance.
"Marino, can you hold her like this so I can get a picture?"
He moved closer to me, and his big gloved hands slid under her left side as I got my camera. I took a photograph of an injury below her left armpit, on the fleshy side of her left breast, as I calculated body temperature versus ambient temperature and how advanced both liver mortis and rigor mortis were. I could hear footsteps and murmurs and someone coughing. I was sweating behind my surgical mask.
"I need some room," I said. Nobody moved.
I looked up at Bray and stopped what I was doing.
"I need room," I sharply said to her. "Get these people out of here."
She jerked her head at everyone but me. Cops dropped surgical gloves in a red biological hazard bag as they went out the door.
"You too," Bray ordered Anderson.
Marino acted as if Bray didn't exist. Bray never took her eyes off me.
"I don't ever want to walk in on a scene like this again," I said to her as I worked. "Your officers, your techs, nobody, and I mean nobody, touches the body or disturbs it in any way before I get there or one of my medical examiners does."
I looked up at her.
"Are we clear on that?" I said.
She seemed to give what I was saying thoughtful consideration. I loaded film in my 35mm camera. My eyes were getting tired because the light was bad, and I took the flashlight from Marino. I shined it obliquely on the area near the left breast, and then on another area on the right shoulder. Bray stepped in closer, brushing against me to see what I was looking at, and it was odd and startling to smell her perfume mingling with the odor of decomposing blood.
"The crime scene belongs to us, Kay," she said. "I understand you haven't had to work things that way in the past. Probably not the entire time you've been here, or maybe anywhere. That's what I was talking about when I mentioned..."
"That's a bunch of bullshit!"
Marino hurled rude words in her face.
"Captain, you stay out of this," Bray fired back.
"You're the one who needs to stay out of it," he raised his voice.
"Deputy Chief Bray," I said, "the law of Virginia states that the medical examiner shall take charge of the body. The body is my jurisdiction." I finished my photographs and met her cold, pale eyes. "The body is not to be touched, altered, or in any way interfered with. Am I clear?" I said again. I pulled off my gloves and angrily threw them into the red bag.
"You have just cut this lady's heart out, evidentially, Deputy Chief Bray."
I closed my scene case and latched it.
"You and the prosecutor are going to get along real good on this one," Marino added furiously as he pulled off his gloves, too. "This kind of case is what's called a free lunch."
He poked a thick finger at the dead woman as if it were Bray who had slaughtered her.
"You just let him get away with it," he yelled at her. "You and your little power games and big tits. Who'd you fuck to get where you are?"
Bray's face went livid.
"Marino,"
I grabbed his arm.
"Let me tell you something."
Marino was out of control, yanking his arm away from me, breathing hard like a wounded bear.
"This lady's beat-up face ain't about politics and sound bites, you goddamn motherfucking bitch! How'd you like it if it was your sister?" "Oh, hell, what am I saying?"
Marino threw his talc-dusted hands up in the air.
"You wouldn't know the first fucking thing about caring about anybody."
"Marino, get the squad in here now," I said.
"Marino's not calling anyone."
Bray's tone had the effect of a metal box slamming shut.
"What are you gonna do, fire me?"
Marino continued to defy her.
"Well, go right ahead, and I'll tell all the reporters from here to fucking Iceland why."
"Firing's too good for you," Bray said.
"Better you continue to suffer out of service and without pay. Dear me, this could go on a very, very long time."
She was gone in a flash of red, like a vengeful queen on her way to order armies to march in on us.
"Oh, no," Marino called after her at the top of his voice. "You got it all wrong, babe. Guess I forgot to tell you I fucking quit."
He got on his radio and raised ham to tell him that the squad needed to get in here, as my mind streaked through formulas that weren't computing.
"Guess I showed her, huh, Doc?" Marino said, but I wasn't listening.
The burglar alarm had gone off at 7:16, and now it was barely 9:30. Time of death was elusive and full of deceit if one weren't careful to account for all of the variables, but Kim Luong's body temperature, liver mortis, rigor mortis, and the condition of her spilled blood weren't consistent with her being dead only 2 hours.
"I feel like this room is shrink-wrapping me, Doc."
"She's been dead at least 4 or 5 hours," I said. He wiped his sweaty face on his sleeve, eyes almost glassy. He couldn't stay still and kept nervously patting the pack of cigarettes in his jeans pocket.
"Since 1 or 2 in the afternoon, you're kidding me. What's he doing all that time?"
His eyes kept going to the doorway, waiting to see who would fill it next. "I think he was doing a lot of things to it," I said.
"I guess I just fucked myself pretty good," Marino said.
Shuffling feet and the clacking of a stretcher sounded from inside the store. Voices were muffled. "I don't think she heard your last diplomatic comment," I answered him. "Might be smart if you leave it that way."
"You think he might have hung out as long as he did because he didn't want to walk out in broad daylight with blood all over his clothes?"
"I don't think that was the only reason," I said, as two paramedics in jumpsuits turned the stretcher sideways to get it through the door. "There's a lot of blood in here," I told them. "Go around that way."
"Jeez,"
one of them said. I took the folded disposable sheets off the stretcher, and Marino helped me spread one of them open on the floor. "You guys lift her a few inches, and we're going to scoot this sheet right under her," I instructed. "Good, that's fine." She was on her back. Gory eyes stared out of shattered orbits. Plasticized paper rustled as I covered her with the other sheet. We lifted her up and zipped her inside a dark red pouch.
"It's getting icy out there," one of the paramedics let us know.
Marino's eyes darted around the store and then out the door into the parking lot, where red and blue lights still strobed, but the attention had significantly waned. Reporters had dashed back to their newsrooms and stations, and only the crime scene technicians and a uniformed officer remained.
"Yeah, right," Marino muttered. "I'm suspended, but you see any other detective here to work this thing? I ought to just let everything go to hell."
We walked back to my car as an old blue Volkswagen Beetle turned into the parking lot. The engine cut so abruptly the clutch popped, and the driver's door flew open, and a teenaged girl with pale skin and short dark hair almost fell out, she was in such a hurry. She ran toward the pouched body as the paramedics loaded it into the ambulance. She raced toward them as if she might tackle them.
"Hey!"
Marino yelled, going after her. She reached the back of the ambulance as the tailgate slammed shut. Marino grabbed her.
"Let me see her!" she screamed. "Oh, please let go of me! Let me see her!"
"Can't do that, ma'am,"
Marino's voice carried. The paramedics swung open their doors and jumped in.
"Let me see her!"
"It's gonna be all right."
"No, no! Oh, please, God!"
Grief tumbled out of her like a waterfall. Marino had her from behind, holding tight. The diesel engine rumbled awake, and I couldn't hear what else he said to her, but he let go of her as the ambulance drove away. She dropped to her knees. She clamped her hands on both sides of her head and stared up at the icy, overcast night, shrieking and wailing and crying out the slain woman's name.
Kim! Kim! Kim!
25. Marino decided to stay with Eggleston and Ham, also known as the Breakfast Boys, while they connected the dots with string at a scene where it wasn't necessary. I went home. Trees and grass were glazed with ice, and I thought all I needed now was a power outage, which was exactly what I got. When I turned into my neighborhood, every house was dark, and Rita, working security, looked like she was holding a séance in the guardhouse. "Don't tell me," I said to her. Candle flames wavered behind glass as she stepped out, pulling her uniform jacket tightly around her. "Been out since about 9:30," she told me, shaking her head. "That's all we ever get in this city is ice." My neighborhood was in a blackout as if a war were going on, and the sky was too overcast to see even a smudge of the moon. I could barely find my driveway and almost fell going up my front stone steps because of the ice. I clung to the railing and somehow managed to find the right key to unlock the door. My burglar alarm was still armed because it was on a backup battery, but that wouldn't last longer than 12 hours, and outages due to ice had been known to go on for days. I punched in my code, then reset the alarm. I needed a shower. There was no way in hell I was going out to my garage to toss my seam clothes in the wash, and the thought of running naked through my pitch-dark house and jumping into a dark shower filled me with horror. Silence was absolute, except for the quiet smacking of sleet. I found every candle I could and began strategically placing them around the house. I located flashlights. I built a fire, and the inside of my house was pockets of darkness with shadows pushed back by several small logs with thin fingers of flame. At least the phone was still working, but of course the answering machine was dead. It was impossible for me to sit still. In my bedroom I finally stripped and washed myself with a cloth. I put on a robe and slippers as I tried to think what I could do to occupy my time, because I was not one to allow empty space in my mind. I fantasized there was a message from Lucy, but I couldn't access it right now. I wrote letters and ended up crumpling them and tossing them into the fire. I watched the paper brown around the edges, ignite, and turn black. Sleet smacked, and it began to get colder inside. The temperature in my house slowly dropped, hours slipping deeper into the still morning.